Flesh. You will be travelling through time with Sarah Morris, the Tudor Travel Guide, uncovering the stories behind some of the most amazing Tudor locations and objects in the UK. Because when you visit a Tudor building, it is only time and not space which separates you from the past. And now over to your host, Sarah Morris.
Hello, it's Sarah, the Tudor Travel Guide here. Welcome to this month's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. This is just a note to say that if you are hearing this, then you are not currently part of my membership programme and will only be hearing the first part of each show. In order to access full episodes of the Tudor History and Travel Show, you will need to become a member of my membership site, The Ultimate Guide to Exploring Tudor England, via the link in the description associated with this podcast. Well, in a moment, I will be introducing the star of today's podcast. But first, just a very quick interlude to let those of you know who are itching to get on the road and perhaps come and tour with me in person that we have at Simply Tudor Tours just very recently launched our flagship tour, The Rise and Fall of Anne Boleyn, for September 2025. In fact, it is the 8th to the 14th of September 2025. Now, we had an amazing time this year on tour. We had such incredible fun. What a wonderful group of people. And it was a real pleasure to share the story of the rise and fall of Anne Boleyn through the places that were so important to her, and which forms such a wonderful backdrop to those dramatic events that crashed through her life. Well, if you are interested, you can check out all the details on the Simply Tudor Tours website. And the link to that will be in the description, but it is simply www.simplytudortours.com. And from the homepage, you will be able to search on our tours and indeed this specific tour. We also have another tour which will be launching very shortly for 2026. That is 1502, the year that shook the Tudor throne, when we will be going in the footsteps of Henry VII and Elizabeth of York. So you might want to keep your eyes out for that. And then finally, our tour in May next year, which begins on the 19th of May for the week, Anne and Elizabeth, mother, daughter, traitors, queens, only has three places left. So if you are thinking about where do I want to go next year and you're itching to see some fabulous Tudor sites and have a great time, you might want to check that out as well. Okay, well, I'm not going to say any more about the tours. As I say, the link will be in the description. But for now, I want to turn our attention to today's star of the show. Oh, wow, what a star. Now, I have to admit that a little over a year ago, I don't think I'd ever heard of this place. And then one day it popped up on my Instagram feed. And I was like, where is this? I've never been. I need to know more. Well, the place in question is the glorious Pitchford Hall, which is a timber-framed Elizabethan building which still stands in pretty much all its glory, although it's had quite a turbulent history, times where it has flourished and sadly fallen into neglect. Now, today's guide is in fact the owner of Pitchford Hall, James Nason. And he and his family have done an exceptional job to save Pitchford from complete ruin. I think it's fair to say that they have been working extremely hard over the last 10 years to bring Pitchford Hall back to its former glory. Now, you're going to hear all about the history of the hall and the family's efforts to preserve it in this podcast. And although it's not generally open to the public, there are special events held throughout the year which would allow you to come and see Pitchford for yourself. And for that reason, and because it is one of England's finest timber-framed houses, I had to include it on an episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. Okay, well, I don't think there's anything more to say. We need to get straight on over there and meet up with the owner, James, who, as I said, will be our guide for today. Good morning, dear listeners, and I say good morning because it is a beautiful, sunny summer's morning here in Shropshire. And oh wow, I am standing outside one of the most magnificent and impressive timber-framed or half-timber-framed houses I think I've ever seen. It is Pitchford Hall in Shropshire, and we are lucky because we have been invited for an exclusive private tour of the hall. And this particular place has a fascinating story, not only in terms of its Tudor history, but actually also its very recent history. Because, as you will hear from its owner, James Nason, who we're going to meet just in a moment, this particular hall was in a terrible and parlous state of repair until the family repurchased it relatively recently and are trying to bring Pitchford Hall back to life. So I am delighted to be able to introduce you to this building. And remember, dear listeners, that as ever, there will be a show notes page associated with this podcast, and we'll make sure that we put lots of pictures in there so that you can see just what we are talking about. Okay, well, I think without further ado, I need to make my way across the gravel courtyard. Oh, and by the way, I have my lovely four-legged friend here with me today. Hello, River. River's my Eurasia, and she is accompanying Chris and I on this podcast recording. So if you hear her whimpering in the background, that's my dog. Anyway, together we are going to explore the hall, and I'm just making my way up a stone flight of stairs to this rather grand wooden door. Let's see if James can answer for us.
Hi, Sarah.
Oh, hello, James. Hello.
Welcome to Pitchford.
Oh, you're most. Yes.
And thanks for knocking loud, because we haven't got a doorbell, I'm afraid. It's another restoration project.
At some point.
Come into the Great Hall.
Thank you so much. So we'll just make our way up a couple of flights, just a small few stairs here. Wow, this is the Great Hall, the original hall of the building.
Yeah, this is the Great Hall. I mean, I'll explain when we go outside. The Great Hall has probably moved around over the years at Pitchford, and you know what we see today is that obviously we're in a Tudor building, but in a sense this is a Victorian interpretation of what they thought a Tudor building or a Tudor Great Hall should look like. So you'll see at Pitchford, there's, you know, it has changed over the ages. Every generation has had a go at adding, you know, bits and pieces to the hall. And every room has probably had a slightly different use over the time. But I'll give you a sense of how it all kind of fits together.
Okay, well, we're going to sort of start to explore the history. And I was just mentioning outside to the listeners how your family has repurchased the hall recently to bring life back into it and hopefully engage as many different people as possible with the future of the hall. But before we do all that, perhaps you could just introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to own the hall.
Yeah, I mean, it all gets a bit emotional in a sense, because I first came to Pitchford in 1991 with my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife. We were at university together at Bristol University, and I remember turning up and being absolutely blown away by the house. I don't think we went to sleep that nice night. We were just exploring, like, you know, I hope you will, Sarah. Over the next few hours. And then kind of tragedy struck in a year later. I remember her, Rowena, coming up to me and saying, my parents have just told me that we have to sell this house. Huge, huge shock, but because it had been her home since 1972. And she was, it was in room A at the time. We've got a lot of alphabetical rooms at Pitchford. And, you know, she was obviously in floods of tears. Oh. And the, you know, it's true, the house was sold. It was offered to the National Trust first, but it didn't work out. It was then offered to English Heritage. It didn't work out. So then it was sold, and all the contents were sold in a Christie's auction. And, you know, a few months later, Rowena's family left. And we made a kind of solemn oath to ourselves that at some point, and we were only, you know, 20-year-olds at this time, at some point in our lives, we would try and, you know, bring Pitchford Hall back into the Pitchford estate. Mm. And we didn't know at that time that we'd have such a restoration task on our hands. But for the 25 years before we managed to reunite the hall with the estate, no one lived here.
Right.
No one stayed a night here. It went derelict. It was on the heritage risk register. English Heritage were getting, you know, very concerned about it. And fortunately, we managed to buy it back in 2016.
Right.
And ever since then, you know, we've been trying to get paintings back, furniture back, life back. And, it, you know, it's great you're visiting today because it's good to see kind of life and interest at Pitchford. And to restore the house. And you'll see, you know, some of the work we're doing in terms of the lime plaster and the lime wash work we're doing and some of the oak framing work. So it's a huge, huge task. But, you know, we make progress every year.
Yeah.
And there's visible progress. And, you know, we like people visiting and seeing the progress we're making in terms of this restoration story. And it's a restoration story of the house, it's a restoration story of the contents, it's a restoration story of the gardens and grounds, and also hopefully research, you know, hopefully we'll encourage people to research, you know, because you'll ask me lots of questions today which I'm afraid I won't know the answer to, because no one's researched this house for,
okay,
you know, 25-30 years.
Okay, wow, wonderful. So we're going to see some of this restoration of the house in progress, and I'd love to certainly circle back towards the end, because I think the story of bringing the contents back into the house is really interesting as well. But I'm in your hands, James, so where should we start our tour?
Well, so when I normally do guided tours, I start, we have lots of brilliant volunteers, and each volunteer starts at a different part in the hall, so we don't kind of clash our groups. But I want to take you out onto, you know, what we call the South Lawn, and you'll really get a sense of the, this is probably the most obviously Tudor part of the house.
It's amazing.
And, you know, there are lots of things I want to show you here. But if in a sense, walk yourself back to 1549, and what we think we had here, where the West Wing is, is probably, you know, the Great Hall that you talked about when we first started. And we think this building was probably by that time quite a derelict Great Hall. And then the Otley family at the time had probably amassed quite a lot of wealth through the kind of North Wales, Shropshire,
so can
wall
I just,
trade.
Can I interrupt? Yeah. So the Otley family were the Tudor owners, or the people who came along,
yes,
and created the Tudor house here at Pitchford.
That's exactly right. And it was a man called Adam Otley. And the Otley family bought the estate in 1473. And you know, we think, and this is why we need more research at Pitchford, really. We think this was, you know, Great Hall, but past its kind of sell-by date in a sense.
So can I just let's describe for the listeners what we're seeing in totality, because it's kind of a U-shaped from this angle, isn't
yes.
it, on the south side. So we've got the central range in front of us, and then projecting out on either side, we've got what, a western and east wing?
Absolutely right.
I just guessed that because you said the west side. So I kind of guessed that must have been the east. you describe it as a part timber frame building. So it's got stone base with the kind of the typical timber frame wattle and daub. beautiful, isn't it? The arrangement of the wood just makes it look so pretty.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's got a red sandstone base. I mean, Pitchford has got almost everything in it. You know, once you start kind of poking around in terms of the restoration work, you'll find Wattle and Daub. You'll find last, you'll obviously find lime plaster, lime wash. You'll find bricks in between some of the half timbering at some point.
James Pitchford, the name, is there a particular reason why it's called that?
Yes, there is. And it's you know, I can actually show you.
Yeah, go on.
We're about 4 or 5 metres away from, you know, evidence of why it's called Pitchford. So you'll see pitch, tar, bitumen, whatever you want to call it.
Yes, I see.
And they've used it to gap up the timbers.
Right.
But I mean, I do think maybe at some point they actually put the pitch on the timbers to waterproof it as well. But Pitchford is, you know, we've got a pitch well about 100 metres away from the hall. And it's very rare to have pitch naturally occurring through the ground. But Pitchford does have it. And guess what? It's right next to a ford.
Okay.
So it's really straightforward once you know
yeah.
that Pitchford has a pitch well or a tar well or whatever you call it, whatever you want to call it.
I didn't even know that existed. I thought people made it. You know, it didn't actually, it wasn't a natural thing that happened, but you've actually got a well and it's still got pitch in it.
It's still got pitch and we'll go and see it. And I'll dig a tiny bit out of pitch out. But it does, I mean, it's ever since, as far as we're concerned, Roman times,
yeah.
you know, it's been identified. And over the there's plenty of historical, you know, points about the pitch at Pitchford.
That's amazing.
And some people call this, I've seen Pitchford be called a magpie house before because, you know, potentially because of the pitch on the
yeah.
timbers.
So today the timbers look kind of reddy brown, but you're saying at some point they may have been covered in black pitch, and so it would have been more a black and white, kind of maybe what a typical...
There's evidence of this red stain, which was originally, as we understand it, meant to be bullock's blood, which was put on the timbers to waterproof them. You know, whether it did, I don't know. It's probably mixed with kind of grease or fat to waterproof. And that's why you see the red on there. There are plenty of areas where there's black. Obviously, there's still big areas of pitch, actually. You can see just up there. But, I mean, a man called Andrew Arrell, who's an architect in Shrewsbury, did a research paper on what, in Tudor times, the half-timbered houses of Shrewsbury were painted. It was everything.
Okay.
I mean, it was greens, it was blues, it was reds, it was, I mean, literally anything you had near you. And bullock's blood would have been in... it wouldn't have been difficult to get hold of bullock's blood. So that the red staining is certainly meant to be, and we've done red staining recently, it's obviously not bullock's blood, but it's meant to represent that. And that's, you know, the redness of the timbers is actually quite important to us at Pitchford. It's not on every side of the hall.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, the magpie thing is that it could have been black and white some time ago.
So... In a moment, I'd love to get back to hearing more about the Otley family and why they came here and what they did. But before we do that, just on a macro level, I always like to understand what was the overall layout? You know, was it a courtyard house? Because at the moment, we've got this, I think, as I've just said, this kind of U-shaped with the three ranges. Very often in the Tudor period, that wasn't uncommon, but you often, more commonly, had a courtyard house with four ranges. So was there ever another range here, or has it always been this shape?
Yeah, funny enough, there was a courtyard, and it seems bizarre to us now that, you know, because it's such a beautiful lawn and it sets off the house so well. But actually, there was a wall between these two wings, and you can slightly see the kind of rise in the ground.
Yes, that's right.
And you would have had a portico just here where you would have accessed the courtyard. But look, I see Pitchford as an E and an F. And in Tudor times, it would have been closer to an E shape or a U shape. And then in 1680, they added another wing. So they extended it essentially to an F. So
right.
If we were in a helicopter in 2024, we would see an F. But hundreds of years ago, we'd see an E or an U. And the clock tower really makes the shallow E. It projects a bit from the northern range, and that gives certainly me a sense of need, albeit a very shallowy.
And the clock tower was added over the porch. When was that?
So we think the clock tower was added in about 1620, and the garderobe tower, which is the other side of the hall, which kind of drains into the stream, or would have drained into the stream, was added about the same time. And this is, Tudors like we do, like adding.
Of course they do, yeah.
You know, when they've got a little bit more money, they like adding a clock tower or a garderobe tower. Yeah. And that's exactly what they did. But yeah, we think it's about 1620s.
Family. Where did they get their money from and why did they come here?
They were the junior branch of a family from North Shropshire that lived in Otley Hall. They lived around this area, Frodsley, Pitchford, and in 1473 they bought the estate. And the estate had gone through the Pitchford family, it had gone through the Bishop of Coventry, the Bishop of St David's, and it eventually ends up with the Otley family in, as I said, 1473. And the man who actually builds the hall is a man called, or who's the owner at the time of the estate, is a man called Adam Otley. And he asks a local carpenter, John Samford, to come and set up, and he leases him some land on the Pitchford estate and asks him to come and build, you know, bring his carpenters and build the hall. Right. The Otley family seemed to get its wealth, and Pitchford for me seems to be a projection of that wealth. You know, it's hard to miss with the kind of the quite intricate timbering, half timbering. But they got their money from the wool trade.
Right.
And that was the kind of North Wales to Shropshire wool trade. And they actually had some land in Calais where they, you know, traded that wool. So, you know, wool in those days was obviously very valuable, not anymore. And this is a projection of that wealth. It suddenly, you know, come to Otley family, and they could do something with it. And they did something very splendid with it ultimately.
Yeah, absolutely. I've just been immersed in the wool men of the Cotswolds. And so I'm very, very attuned at the moment to how much money was just involved in that trade. I mean, it was probably our premier industry during the period that you're talking about. So lots of money to be had if you were involved in that business. Okay, so the first family, the first people to move in here were, what were their names?
It would have been Adam. Otley and the family. And what we think is that they took, you know, this kind of derelict great hall.
Yes.
Essentially restored it or refurnished it. And so why we think this is that some of the timbers, and we think they're from about the 1280s, are still in the attic space, still in the roof space. And lots of experts over the years have come and said that, you know, those are not, you know, 1550s beams. Those are 1280, 1300 beams. So we think the West Wing was where the first work happened.
Was it like a hall house, do you think? Did any of that, you know, just sort of simple hall with then at one end, the living arrangements and the solar, and that's what was here. And then the Tudor or the late medieval period, they came and built these other ranges.
I think that's absolutely right.
Right.
And so, you know, we've got a date of 1549 on the West Wing.
Yeah.
Then where we just think it evolves in terms of the northern range, you know, probably over a kind of 5 or 10 year period. And then the East Wing, and why we think, you know, this evolution in a sense is captured in the half timbering, because here we've got, you know, it's pretty straightforward close studding, and then this side, and we, let's say this is 20 or 30 years later, you know, we've got lozenges, we've got chevrons, we've got these barley twists. And one feature that's so important for us at Pitchford is the little faces. And all the way around, at the bottom of the barley twists, you have these faces. Now, I always understood these as the faces of the carpenters that built this incredible building. And so, in a sense, you know, we're hopefully looking at the faces of a 1550, 1560 carpenter, with their moustaches and, you know, potentially their hats.
Yeah.
And they're probably about 10 of these masks around, you know, in the carpentry of the hall.
Entranceway was originally this way, which is through the garden and leads towards like a bank. Is that right, or have I got it completely?
You're very close to where the carriages would have stopped to let out, you know, their passengers and allow them to go in the hall. So where this sundial is now is where I think the carriages, you know, would have stopped, and then they would have gone up into the stable yard. Uh-huh. The stable yard is brick, as you see it, but in those days it would have been half timbered, a beautiful Tudor thing. The actual entrance to Pitchford is through this piece of land, through the grounds, through the parkland, the original entrance.
So may I just, or maybe you could just describe what we can see, and we'll take a photo of this, dear listeners, so you can see the view that we're discussing, because it's beautiful. Maybe you could describe it.
Yeah, I mean, it's classic English parkland with oak trees. Some of these oak trees must be, you know, 500, 600 years old. We've got what we call the Roebrook coming just about 10, 15 metres away from the house. There used to be a bridge here. Now it's just a weir.
Right.
But the carriages would have swept through the avenue, past those actually sycamore trees up there, then through the oak trees, and on this little rise, and there was a bridge just here, and the carriages would have come across the bridge, across the lawn, to what is now the sundial, and just, you know, into the hall. The Victorians built up these are kind of retaining walls. So it's no longer quite like that. The bridge is gone. The bridge was actually moved down there by the Victorians.
Oh, so that's the bridge that was over there.
Exactly. You know what the Victorians are like.
Oh, God, they made their creation, their version
Exactly. But yeah, that's the entrance. And you know, the cows are...
But you can see the roadway. You can see the flattened bridge there. Still,
I mean, when it gets, if we're in a drought, you actually kind of almost see the kind of cart tracks, carriage tracks. So you know, you're absolutely right.
But this is an... we should pause just right now, because I know it's a beautiful summer's day, which really, really helps. It is, as you say, a quintessentially idyllic English scene, landscape. Even the cows lying down in the field over there just add to the sort of the beauty of the place. This has a particular feel coming here. It is quite isolated, isn't it?
It is very isolated. And the houses, Country Life did an article about Pitchford 3 years ago, and they compared it with two other, you know, large Tudor houses. And they talked about Speke Hall, you know, near Liverpool, and they talked about Little Morton Hall in Cheshire. I'm obviously a little bit biased here. They're both amazing houses, but Pitchford is in a much more tranquil setting in the kind of midst of the Shropshire, or in the folds of the Shropshire hills. So the rolling kind of countryside here feels very, very rural, feels very tranquil, apart from
the
Derek Derek, the brilliant Derek, who's one of the heroes at Pitchford in terms of saving this place. Apart from the mowing machine, it's normally silent here. And you know, sadly for Speke, it's near an airport, and Little Morton Hall is you know, near an A road, so you don't quite have that tranquility that, you know, maybe we would have had 400 years ago. So Pitchford just feels really settled in that incredibly rural kind of Shropshire setting, and beautiful, just the beauty of the parkland. Really,
I could just put myself a chair here with a nice little gin and tonic, and just I bet you do that, don't you?
May have happened once or twice.
Now, where do we need to go next, James?
We need to go up to the treehouse.
Okay, let's go. Because the treehouse. Now, I have to say, I've seen a couple of pictures, and it's famous, isn't it? Pitchford and its treehouse, absolutely famous.
Yeah, I always say when we do the guided tours that it's a real gem for Shropshire, actually, because you know, it is the world's oldest treehouse. It goes back to, you know, I think probably about 1670, 1680, but it could be, I mean, I've seen some experts say, you know, possibly 1630, 1640, and we think it's part of the kind of pleasure grounds of Pitchford.
So rather than have one of those formal banqueting halls, which were often little pavilions sited on domes or little towers at the side of the garden, you've got a treehouse.
Yeah, it's in an elevated spot. I mean, Pitchford is in a way set in a hollow, which is very protective in a way from, you know, the winds. And it's nice to be in a hollow in a cold kind of winter. But the actual treehouse is on the highest bit of land around the hall, so it gives you a really elevated position and a view, you know, of the Shropshire Hills, and particularly the Long Mynd.
So we are walking uphill. You might be able to hear me huffing and puffing a little bit more into the microphone. Sorry about that, dear listeners. And we're just making our way up away from the house. Right. So yes, it's got to be pretty unique, a treehouse to be built as a sort of a pleasure pavilion at the time. Do we know of any others?
There was obviously a bit of a craze in Shropshire at that time.
Okay.
For treehouses. And there was one in near Ludlow. Uh-huh. And there was one in a place called Dot Hill, and neither of them exist anymore. So Pitchford really is the only one we've got left. And you can see it now. It's in the kind of boughs of this broadleaf lime.
The lime itself.
And this is why I slightly date the treehouse.
Yeah.
They think the lime tree was probably planted in about 1500 or maybe 1550.
Really?
And then work out how long does a lime have to grow before it can hold, you know, a treehouse.
Right.
To this extent. And you'll see, I mean, it's absolutely an ancient tree. There's a hollowness there, but it's still, you know, every spring the leaves keep on coming back. So hopefully, it is apparently we think it's the oldest broadleaf lime in the British Isles.
Really?
I think I'm right in saying the treehouse is the only listed treehouse. I think it's the only treehouse that appears on an Ordnance Survey map, and obviously it's the world's oldest treehouse. So it's got lots of this incredible tree. And a treehouse that it holds.
Look at this tree. I love trees. Hello, tree.
Well, I think it's important to hold and
I think it is touch a tree and appreciate the tree. Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. It has been here for...
And it's obviously support. The big branches are supported by these pillars, which you'll see on the images. Chris is busy taking a few pictures of us, so you'll be able to see that. So can we go upstairs?
Yes, yeah, of course. Yeah.
Let's... Now, River, you're going to stay here. She'll probably start moaning, won't you? Bit of whimpering.
So here we go. And it, you know, it's done. The beauty of the treehouse is it's done in, you know, half timbered style. So it works very well with the hall. Let me just.
Oh my goodness me. Look at this. Oh, it's even got plaster ceiling. Is this plaster or cardboard?
No, you're right, you're absolutely right, it's plaster. And we think the plaster was, probably the date for the plaster is about 1760s.
Right.
It's got these incredible windows as well that I just absolutely love the
aren't
shape
they
of
beautiful?
Them.
Very fragile, aren't they?
Everything needs a bit of restoration at Pitchford, so, and the treehouse certainly needs. It was last restored in 1980. By my mother-in-law.
Right.
So it definitely needs some more restoration, but it's you know, actually, to be honest, it's considering it's in this really exposed position and gets all the weather from across the Shropshire Hills and Wales, it's done pretty well.
So we're looking out, aren't we, across the fields, to the hills in the distance, Shropshire Hills.
Yep.
I mean, really far-reaching views. I can just imagine this when it was first made and the family coming up here and being very proud of their new treehouse and pleasure folly.
They think there may have been a deer park here as well.
So,
you know, you could have been in this elevated position looking down at your herd of deer,
or maybe even I don't know they hunted from up here, do you think?
Yeah, it's
the
possible,
ladies with crossbows.
Yes,
because they
yes.
used to certainly in the Tudor period they would drive the deer in front of a stand. Rather than having to get on your horse and chase.
It's a really good point, because the Haha is about what, 10 or 15 meters away, so he's easy within you know, a distance of an arrow from a bow or a crossbow.
Yeah.
So I think it's a really good thought.
Yeah. How interesting. Fascinating. I love it. Do you ever have picnics up here?
We do. We also use it for charity kind of tea parties and things like that. Maybe we'll do a secret supper up here at some point.
At the end of our chat, we should talk about obviously what you're doing in terms of events and how people can make the most of coming here. Could you rent this for your own little birthday party or anything like that? Do you ever do that?
Well, I love the idea of doing. We did in the Orangery. We did actually before it was restored. We did a pop up. Supper for three or four nights with a local forager.
Oh lovely.
And people actually really appreciated that. They love the evening, and I've approached a few people about possibly doing kind of secret supper or pop-up supper in the treehouse. I think it'd be quite a special evening.
Yeah, it'd be lovely, because you've got this area around it as well, which is also lovely, so you can kind of spill out and
Very quickly, this is the successor lime tree. So one of the first things we did when we got back to Pitchford in 2016 is to take a cutting from the lime.
Wow.
So maybe in 100 years, 150 years, the treehouse will move
brilliant.
to this lime. It's about a metre and a half at the moment.
Yeah, about that.
So that is hopefully the future of the Pitchford lime.
Oh, that is lovely. What a great idea. That's fantastic. From the original tree.
You're absolutely right.
That's just wonderful.
the countryside is just full of life going on at the moment, isn't it, with the grass being cut and harvested. And
you've got
it's a idyllic English scene.
You've got tractors, mowers and cows.
Yeah.
And a little bit of a breeze now.
Yeah. Yeah,
and then you see, yeah, from the treehouse, you can see the hall. So you've just got this beautiful view through the
tree. This is a lovely view, isn't it?
It is, isn't it? And so, you know, the window of the treehouse does align particularly with the west wing bedroom. Mm. And that was where, certainly in the last 100, 200 years, that would be the master bedroom for the
right.
hall.
Right.
So that alignment, I think, is quite important and interesting.
Has Pitchard Hall ever been involved in filming for any period dramas or films?
It has, actually. There was about a year and a half ago, there was a film. It hasn't come out yet, but it won some awards last weekend at Cannes. So I'd hope to see that. It's a World War I drama. And the lead actor returns to a shuttered house after the war, and Pitchford is your shuttered house, and it's all under kind of dust sheets.
You could relate to that, right?
We can relate to that because that's exactly the experience we had in 2016 when we returned to the hall, and we spent, you know, 2 months just cleaning up dust and you know, getting the house in a better shape.
25 years worth of dust. That'd be quite a lot of dust to clear up.
That's right.
Okay, so that's the treehouse. Now, you mentioned a pitch well. I've got to see this because I've never seen one before. So please lead the way.
Yeah, it's about 500, it's about 500, 600 metres. We'll just go past the church. Then we go down what I think was a Roman road. And that's why we think there was a connection between, you know, the Romans and the pitch.
Uh-huh.
We'll go past the church. They found a carving of what they think was Pluto in the church. So there's a quite interesting dynamic between the pitch well and the church. There was a sense that the pitch well was perhaps a slightly dark well.
Uh-huh.
And the church
was
is
the
kind
light.
Of a balance, the light. And
the
they're
dark
bouncing
and the
up.
Light.
So the dynamic between the pitch well that's just there and the church, which is on slightly elevated land above the pitch well, actually is quite interesting. I'm sure the Tudors would have... And, you know, medieval England would have picked up on dark pitch oozing up from the ground.
Oh, yes.
That's slightly scary.
I would have thought so. And you believe this might be a Roman road simply because of some of the connections with the Pluto and so on in the church?
Yeah, I mean, on some of the old ordnance survey maps from the, you know, say the 1892 2 version, I think, it's marked as a Roman road. There's a Roman road that goes across the estate and from what used to be called, obviously, in Roman times, Viriconium, but it's now Wroxeter. It's an English heritage site about 5 miles away. And the road that goes all the way down to Lentwardine goes across the estate. So there's lots of Roman activity around here. There's the abutments of a Roman bridge still on the estate. So we know there was plenty of... I mean, Viriconium was a huge, essentially kind of Roman city in Roman Britain at that time. And that, it's a few miles away. So
I didn't realise it was so close, because it is, even though I'm a Tudor nut, I actually would love to go and see Wroxeter because it looks incredible as a site.
Yeah, and it's so close.
Yeah,
you know, it really is.
Oh, I see something that looks like a well.
Yeah, it's a shallow well, and it's in this grove of yew trees and a few beech trees.
Yes, we're in the middle of woodland, aren't we? It's a really shady spot.
We are. We're just by the bridge we saw as well, which. You know, so we've got the ford here, we've got the, you know, drive, the Oak Avenue, and then I'll just get down into the well. I mean, okay. It really is. And people say to me, was it deeper? Funnily enough, I don't think it was much deeper. Uh-huh. And I don't think it needs to be that much deeper, because the pitch comes out, and I'm just going to get a little stick and I'll...
So hopefully, yes, Chris is getting a picture of this moment. So
that's a bit. You can always tell because it's much harder than that.
Oh, I see.
Oh, I'm not going to pick. Well, actually, I will pick it up. But okay, so smell this. And
oh, yes.
Yeah.
That's the stuff you smell when they're putting new...
It's pitch, it's tar, bitumen, whatever you want to call it, and it just naturally occurs from here. I mean, you can see bits of it here, a big bit here that people have taken out on one of our guided tours, but that just keeps on, it just keeps on emerging from the ground. So, you know, why wouldn't you use this to waterproof a timber building or coracles? There's a big coracle tradition in this part of the country, with kind of Armbridge coracles and Shrewsbury coracles, and you know, the pitch goes on the coracles to waterproof them.
Wonderful. Well, that's absolutely a first for me, and certainly for the Tudor Travel Guide followers. So, wow, I've learnt something new. As I said to you before, James, I had no idea that pitch was naturally occurring. I thought it was something that workmen made up to put on.
It's fine. I think there are a few pitch wells in America. I think there was an article in the Times a few years ago about the Pitchford pitch well, but one in Italy as well. Actually, you get a really good view of the hall.
I was going to say, going across this bridge, yeah.
And you can see some of the restoration. We're just doing a section of the lime plaster on the east wing.
It's really stunning. Fantastic views.
You see on the right is the garderobe tower that I was talking about, that little tower that does look like
that
it's kind of almost
out.
Exactly, it's almost added, well, it was added on, and you know, still the loos and the bathrooms are in that right. Garderobe tower. They don't drain into the stream anymore,
and a lovely sort of bay window there. That's quite an unusual feature. Is that added later, or is
it
that
is it is we think it's kind of late 1700s, right. And you know, when we go into the drawing room, it really opens up the parkland. You get just a wonderful view from the you know, drawing room. It's a lovely oak paneled room, but that does enhance the view, having that bow window. I'm not sure all Tudor purists love the bow window, because it is a bit of a, it does slightly interrupt that the east wing, but from, you know, actually living in the house, it does give you such a great view of the countryside around us and the bridge.
Now I have an appetite to get inside and go exploring, so can we go there next?
We can. There's a lot to see with you know, priest holes and
you know,
all the kind of loads of rooms and the oak panelling, etc., etc., and some of the Tudor, you know, paintings as well, mm-hmm. that I must show you.
been listening to the first part of this month's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. The remainder of this episode is only available to members of my membership site, The Ultimate Guide to Exploring Tudor England. To join the wait list to become a member of The Ultimate Guide, click on the link in the description associated with this podcast. You will be added to the waiting list and I will email you just as soon as the doors to the membership next reopen. I'll see you there. Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. If you've loved the show, please take a moment to subscribe, like and rate this podcast so that we can spread the Tudor love. Until next time, my friends, all that remains for me to say is happy time travelling!